I feel like most of us have a movie from our childhood that really made an impression on us. Can you think of what yours is? Shout it out.
Labyrinth.
Labyrinth, all right. Princess Bride. Did I hear one over here?
Last of the Mohicans.
Last of the Mohicans. Bambi?
Yeah.
I mean, can anyone watch some, like, Babar movie? God, I, like, cried and cried and, like, yeah. I, like, couldn't finish that one. Some of the highlights from my childhood, probably the first one would be when I watched The Matrix for the first time. I remember getting to that part where Morpheus is explaining to Neo that, like, every part of his reality is actually just a computer program. We were sitting in the basement watching it with my dad, and he, like, paused the DVD and was like, "Do you know what's going on?" And I remember him asking that, but I mostly just remember the internal cogs in my brain just being like, am I in a computer? How would I know? Maybe this is a secret message for me, telling me that I'm in the Matrix. Or there was, of course, the classic reveal in Empire Strikes Back. How many of you have seen Empire Strikes Back? How many of you have not seen Empire Strikes Back? All right, well, I'm not gonna ruin it for you. But it's big. Another movie that made a big impression on me, but in a different way, you know, kind of Star Wars and The Matrix, that kind of compelled me towards something. This was a movie, you like Star Wars? Yeah? I like it too, a lot. Very excited about December. All right. And in the same genre, I'm going to go stick with Lucasfilm, but it was Indiana Jones. So those other movies, they kind of compelled me towards something heroic. One of the Indiana Jones movies kind of repulsed me and pushed me away from the story. And I imagine most of you know what I'm going to talk about, which is, of course, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. So putting aside the terrible caricatures of non-white people in Indiana Jones that are terrible. The story goes that they're in India, they're following these kind of cultist gangsters into this temple, and they realize that they are about to sacrifice a human being to their god to accomplish whatever aim, you know, evil aim that they're supposed to be doing. I can't even remember that part. It was mostly just freaked out about what happens next. Because what happens is the lead priest, you know, ushers in the person who's about to be sacrificed, who seems to be coming mostly willingly, and then using what I can imagine was the best, like, CGI effects / ingenious props that they've ever created. They show the priest, like, reaching into the man's chest, right? Like, and you kind of felt it, right? It was like you kind of felt that, like, squishiness, both of, like, what it would be like to reach in, and also it kind of felt like someone was getting your heart. Am I describing this in too much detail for some of you? All right. Well, that's what it was like. And then, of course, he pulls out the man's heart and, like, lifts it up, and it's, like, still beating, right? You can still see it pulsing. And then they, like, lower this cage down into what looks like the center of the earth, and it burns up, and then his heart, as he's burning up, burns up at the same time, and you're like, what? And then I probably didn't watch the rest of the movie because I was so freaked out. There's something about, like, watching movies as a kid that you kind of wonder, like, is this telling me something about the world that I, like, didn't know? And so, like, after I watched that movie, I kind of wondered, like, is this a thing that actually happens? Like, do we actually sacrifice people by, like, tearing out their hearts? And I remember asking, I think, my dad or one of my parents about this, and they said, well, we don't do it in that way anymore like we used to, but, you know, you shouldn't have to worry about this. Which is comforting, I guess, right? But as I've grown older, I've realized that, I mean, we do have sacrifices in our lives that have very human costs. And that moment in that movie kind of made me wonder about myself. Would I ever be able to sacrifice myself or sacrifice a part of myself so viscerally? And what would that be? What cause would that be? What devotion would I have that would ask me or compel me to make such an offering? Now, in this series, we're exploring how freedom, the freedom to live into being who we want to be, who the world needs us to be, takes discipline. It takes a cultivation in the present to allow us to become what we need to be in the future. And today I want to explore how sacrifice plays into that equation, how the disciplines that we need to embark on now to build the future that we want collectively necessitate sacrifice. But sacrifice is a very complex, gnarly, and problematic concept. I mean, we're just here, tomorrow is Veterans Day. In Canada, where I'm from, we call it Remembrance Day. This is commemorating the 11th hour of the 11th day when World War I, the armistice, was signed. It was to be the war that ended all wars. Millions of people died on the battlefields. Hundreds of thousands of people's lives displaced, destroyed. Whole cities crumbled. And the sacrifice narrative was, of course, employed. It was employed to compel people into battle. It was employed to evoke the better angels of our nature, of the bravery that we saw as people put down their life for their companions or for their country. And so we remember those moments, and we know how these narratives of sacrifice, of giving yourself for a greater good, have now and have always been used by those in power to manipulate, to lay down other people's lives, to, in the accounting of the sacrifice, downplay what is lost and overplay what will be gained. Now, of course, sacrifice is a part of life. And the narrative of sacrifice used by those in power usually demand those who have the least to give up the most. Sacrificial narratives are woven into the very heart of this country's mythology. I mean, America was born out of a violent revolution. People died to create the Republic. Sacrifice is glorified. It's glorified in classic ways, in the box office hits of movies that show sacrifice in war, the valor of those in the armed service. But also it's part of our life as we think about the ways that parents are asked to sacrifice for their children. Often, of course, unseen is the way that women in our country labor under a disproportionate impact of that sacrifice. But there's also more insidious narratives of sacrifice that live inside the heart of this country. The ways in which phrases like collateral damage in war seem to justify civilian death or environmental devastation. Or the ways that we seem to over and over again sacrifice the lives of school children on the altar of the gun industry and the Second Amendment. Or the ways in which the policies that we enact towards the poor sacrifice another generation to live in poverty and allow those with enough to continue to have more. When we think about sacrifice, we should always ask the question, who is sacrificed and for whom? Now, stories of sacrifice are always a transaction. They're always a transaction in which some thing is exchanged for another. And the stories in our culture tell us that much of the time these sacrifices are worth it in the end, that the accounting works out. Or maybe that the sacrifices were unavoidable. There was nothing we could have done to prevent it. And yet these narratives are usually held and disseminated by those who have the most power. As Reverend Karen Hutt, a Black and queer UU minister and current vice president of student experience and culture at the United Theological Seminaries of the Twin Cities, wrote in a recent article, "Sacrifice is almost always a mechanism in which loss and gain have been made equivalent. the balance settled, like trading a mountain for jobs in the mining sector, like trading a forest for a highway and a faster commute. In her article, American Sacrifice, Reverend Hutt introduced me to the work of Derrick Bell. Now, Derrick Bell was the first Black tenured professor in law at Harvard University, and he was one of the founders of critical race theory. And in 1992, he wrote this profound book called Faces at the Bottom of the Well, The Permanence of Racism, in which he diagnosed our society as not being like abnormal for having racism, but in fact that racism was normal. And that the narrative of, oh, it will get better over time, was not only false, but harmful for the movement of liberation for Black people in this country. Now, this was an academic book filled with legal and sociological arguments. But at the end of the book, he did this curious thing where he included a short work of science fiction that he wrote entitled Space Traders that involved the United States coming in contact with some extraterrestrials. And because you're probably confused enough already, I want to tell you the story. So this is in 1992. The story takes place in the year 2000, so kind of 8 years into the future. So I'm going to invite you to think as if this story is happening 8 years into the future. So it's the year, what would that be, 2027? Yeah? Great. It's the year 2027. The United States of America is in crisis. Environmental destruction runs rampant. The national debt is climbing higher and higher, and fossil fuels are running low. A week before the year turns, the world is blanketed with an announcement from a race of extraterrestrials on all radios, TVs, Rokus, and everything else in between. They herald the announcement of these extraterrestrials, and they say that they're going to come visit humanity, and they've picked the east coast of the United States to be the place they're going to land. Who knows why? But it's going to happen on January 1st. So January 1st of the year, people swarm the beaches of the east coast. How many of you would be those people that would swarm the beaches of the east coast as the aliens arrive? Well, the 8:30 service was much more enthusiastic than y'all. There was at least 15 of them that were like, yep, I'm there. So crowds are swarming the beaches. Dignitaries from the United States are prepared to welcome these guests. And giant ships descend down, open their doors, and the beings, regal in appearance, walk upon the water. They approach the dignitaries. The vice president of the United States is there. The president is in some safe bunker somewhere, of course. And because the aliens apparently learned how to speak English by listening to tapes of Ronald Reagan, this is the story, and this is the actual description in the book, they spoke to the dignitaries in the, quote, comforting tones of President Reagan. They told the dignitaries before the humans had anything, could say anything, that within the ships was enough gold to bail out every level of government in the United States. That they had special chemicals capable of unpolluting the environment and restoring it to its pristine beauty. That they had an engine and a nuclear power system that was completely safe and could run in perpetuity and solve the fossil fuel crisis. And they were willing to give the United States all of these gifts. The only thing they wanted in return was to take back to their home solar system all of the African Americans who lived in the United States. That's all they wanted. There was, of course, a stunned silence that met this offer. The aliens hastened to tell them that this would be a free trade, that they would not force or compel in any way, and that they would return in 16 days on January 17th, or MLK Day, to receive the answer. The president, of course, convened his cabinet, his all-white cabinet, to figure out how to respond. I've never considered myself a particularly courageous individual, Mr. President, said the Secretary of Interior, a man described as small in stature, but with a mind both sharp and devious. He continued, but if I could guarantee the prosperity for this great country by giving my life or going off with the space traders, I would do it without hesitation. And if I would do so, I think every red-blooded American with 1 ounce of patriotism would as well. The secretary sat down to the warm applause of his colleagues. Now, around the table, although not on the cabinet, was one of the president's advisors, a professor from a local university who was African-American, Professor Golightly. He was the only advisor. He was often out of step with his community because of his support for the president's policies, and he stood up and said that while his patriotism might equal that of the Secretary of the Interior, he did not think it was wise to compel that sort of patriotism upon his wife, his children, and every black citizen, and said that this would account for or essentially be a group banishment. He would put his life on the line, but he asked, could we ask his wife and children to do the same? Now, of course, the aliens gave no indication for how they were going to treat those they asked for. Would they be food? Would they be pets? Would they be subjects of experimentation? Perhaps they would be protected or maybe even worshipped. As the story progresses, white characters in the story even spoke of the aliens, quote, knowing of the plight of African Americans, and maybe they had come to save them. But the extraterrestrials provided no answers. As you can imagine, groups began to mobilize on either side. Liberal and civil rights groups vehemently attacking this proposal. Even a coalition of business leaders started to gather, worried about 16% of their market disappearing overnight. Some environmental groups were on the fence. Jewish groups came out against this another final solution. And the president decided that he was going to put this to a vote, that they would amend the Constitution of the U.S. to essentially draft all African-American citizens, but that the people would have to decide. So at one of these meetings where this professor is speaking to those who are opposed to this, he says, it has become an unwritten tradition in this country for whites to sacrifice our rights to further their own interests. This tradition overshadows the national debate about the space traders, which is what they called them, the space traders' offer, and may well foretell our reply to it. I realize that our white liberal friends continue to reassure us, this is America, they tell us, it can't happen here, but I've noticed that those whites who are most vigorous in their assurances are least able to rebut the contrary teachings of both historical fact and present reality. In fact, this professor, this black professor, whose own life is at stake, said that the only way he could foresee this motion being defeated in the general populace would be to embrace it, for these groups to come out and say that as African Americans, they would want to go with the aliens, to spread a rumor that they were going to an amazing metropolis where all of their needs were being met, and because if white people thought that black people were getting a better deal, they would vote against it. A cruel logic. The referendum passed 70-30. 70% of the country voting for the banishment of all African Americans, and they were loaded up onto the beaches from which many of their ancestors were brought forcibly generations before. Reverend Hutt, in reflecting on this story, said that in 1992, when it came out, she remembers talking about it with black and white friends, and that their reactions were reminiscent of the OJ verdict in 1995. Very different responses. Many white friends were horrified by the story, unable to believe that such a vote could happen in the year 2000 when the story was set. Many black friends were horrified that white people were so naive to believe that it could not happen. And yet there was still a smaller set, Karen included, who pondered leaving the U.S. for what could be a better life with the aliens. Many of us said that anything might be better than this place, that they were willing to take the trip on a spaceship because the unknowable future might provide me with a new hope that I lacked after 400 years in America. I wonder how you responded to this story. Aliens aside, how believable the verdict was. I wonder how the way you grew up and your social location influenced your reaction. I wonder how it helps us think about this question, who is sacrificed over and over again and for whom? Now, the 2020 Democratic primaries are kind of in full swing, and it's been curious that the question of reparations for slavery has come up in some of the debates. This is, of course, the question of whether or not, after reaping the financial rewards of generations of unpaid labor, whether this country owes a debt to those ancestors of slaves. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts about what scenario would seem more likely. The scenario offered in Space Traders, where African Americans by popular vote were sent off into the unknown custody of aliens in return for gold, unlimited energy, and an end to global climate change. Or by popular vote, this country authorizing the payment of reparations to African American descendants of slavery based on that 40 acres and a mule promise adjusted for inflation, so let's say about $80,000 per descendant. Which referendum do you think would pass? Reparations or the space trade? Now, the difference between these scenarios is, of course, who is being asked to sacrifice. Are those who occupy a privileged place asked to give it up? Or are those who already live at the margins asked to give it all up again? Who is sacrificed and for whom? And yet there's a deep complication to this question of sacrifice, isn't there? Because sacrifice is a part of life. Doing the work of love in life has a cost that is not easy to pay and sometimes asks all of us, not only our lives, but sometimes metaphorically having our hearts ripped out from within us. We speak in this congregation of unleashing courageous love, that is our work. And courageous love is this intersection where the love of self, the love of other, and the love of the world come together, and sacrifice is a part of that. Giving up a part of ourselves to ensure a greater wholeness is a part of that. But how do we know when we're offering at the altar of love a sacrifice or the altar of something else? Who is sacrificed and for whose gain? Who reaps a deeper freedom? What type of freedom does it allow? As I was preparing for this sermon, I encountered this wonderful reflection by the white UU minister, Reverend Ruth McKenzie, who has a fascinating title. She is the Minister of Pastoral Care and Worship Architecture. Worship architecture, interesting, at the First Universalist Church of Minneapolis. And she wrote about a scientist who studied trees. Suzanne Simard was doing her doctoral work in British Columbia and the forests that she grew up in. And she went out into the forest and she planted two trees beside each other. One was a Douglas fir and one was a paper birch. And I should have asked Scott to help me with the science, but from what I understand, they did science magic. And they were able to kind of track where the nutrients from each of the tree would end up. So they used isotopes or some other word that I don't know what it means. And after a year, they could see where the nutrients that were in the tree ended up. Did they end up in the soil? Did they end up in a plant far away? And after the first year of the trees just growing beside each other, They went and they saw that very quickly the roots of these two different trees had begun to intermingle. And when they checked the isotopes, they saw that the nutrients from one of the trees, the birch, had ended up in the fir, and nutrients from the fir had ended up in the other one. Whatever that one it was, right? The birch, thank you. Gretchen's laughing in the corner. Do you hear her? We have a very supportive colleague right now. And they found this amazing underground network made up of fungi and mushrooms that through the root systems connected these trees and actually were able to allow them to communicate. The next year of the study, though, they did something different. They shaded the fir tree. So it had less access to air. They had less access to the sun. And they came back and they noticed that the isotopes or the nutrients, that there were more of the birch's nutrients in the fir than there was before. That the more stressed out the fir became, the more the birch offered it in return. And it was a radical hypothesis or finding at the time. And it was opposite to what most ecologists had thought for generations, that we were in this competition, right? The survival of the fittest, that species wouldn't cooperate with each other, but they would fight each other. She characterized, after sharing this, that people actually threw eggs at her. And yet, she was finding out what indigenous peoples for millennia have known, which is that trees communicate to each other, that the forest has a way of sharing the nutrients around, that there is a vast interconnected network of roots below the surface that we don't see, that there is a way in which the trees talk. They actually found that when a tree is infected with insects or disease, it sends out messages to other trees that say, "Don't connect with me." There are these mother trees in the forests that send out the roots and give of themselves over and over again to allow other species to live. That in fact, forests have elders. Now, of course, this may evoke that story that many of us grew up with, or I grew up with, that many people don't like, which is Shel Silverstein's The Giving Tree, right? The story in which this tree gives everything, including allowing itself to be cut up, to be given to this child, who was an adult at the time. And while that version of sacrifice, I think, goes too far, when you walk in a forest, you quickly realize that it wouldn't be a forest if there was only a single tree. And somehow the forest knows that too, that the sacrifice, in quotes, of the nutrients from one of the trees to the other isn't actually a sacrifice for the forest as a whole, but in fact, it's just a way of allowing it to thrive in totality. But how do we know? How do we know when what our sacrifice is being asked of us is allowing the whole to thrive, or simply us being drained of all that we are and all that we have? I struggle with it. Maybe you do too. A struggle to know what to give and what to keep close. Ruth, in her article, recounts an encounter with a priest or an advisor that explored this concept of sacrifice. The priest said to her that sacrifice is more than giving up or sacrificing in order to be spiritually good, that there is something in the giving that increases the gift and it comes back on itself in the experience of receiving. It's an offering that expands the well-being, the life force of the exchange, that it is the exact opposite of coercion or violence or exploitation, that it is, and this is the phrase that kind of haunts me, it is a way into unitive living. Unitive living. Living as if that interdependent web of which we all are part, truly connects us all with both our care and our need to nourish it. Love has a cost. Courageous love exacts of us much of what we have in our lives, and yet, if you've witnessed a true act of courageous love, you know that in the giving up, there is a deep receiving for what is able to be unlocked and unleashed in the world. I don't know if I'll ever be in a circumstance in which someone will literally reach into my chest and pull out my beating heart. I hope not. I hope I'm under general anesthesia if it does happen. And yet I do know that day after day, this world does reach into my heart and pull it out, still beating. And that this world asks of me and us some deeper sacrifice for those other people to experience a deeper freedom too. I don't know how we figure it out. I don't think it's clear. I don't think it's easy. And yet it is something that we must wrestle with every day of our lives. Amen, and blessed be.